Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have you with us on this day before the runoff election in the state of Georgia. And, of course, that's the story we'll be talking about throughout the show this afternoon. There are a couple of other tidbits that are worth mentioning as well. But before we go anywhere else, let me say that, remind you, this is it. This is our big week here on Political Rewind. We start a four-day-a-week schedule today. We're now going to be on the air Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. So we add Tuesday to the schedule starting tomorrow. We're all working out. We're all getting set for this. I've been doing extra exercises. Jim Galloway is here today. Hi, Jim.
I've been trying to get extra sleep.
Yeah. Hi, Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He writes in the Wednesday and Sunday paper, and he oversees the Political Insider blog at Politically Georgia, part of myajc.com. Yeah, you guys, this election season, you know, I sit in a studio and talk. You actually have to really get out there and report some, write some.
Well, the younger people do a whole lot of that.
Well, I'm glad you're here today to help us unwind what's going to be happening tomorrow. We also have with us today State Representative Brenda Lopez back. We're really glad you could be back. Gwinnett County just finished her first term, getting set to move forward in the state legislature. Hi, Brenda.
Well, hello. Always a great pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks. Todd Rehm is here. He's a Republican strategist. He is also the editor of GeorgiaPundit.com, which you can find online every day. Hi, Todd.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me. Always happy to be here.
Well, we always like having you because you keep us in touch with all the things, the local things that are really worth our talking about. And we have a lot to talk with you about today, especially in terms of early voting numbers. Mary Margaret Oliver, Democrat from Decatur, House member from Decatur, sitting next to you. Hello, Mary Margaret.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the invitation.
Glad to have you here. And also with us, Heath Garrett, a Republican strategist, works with lots of Republicans over the years, worked with a lot of them over the years. But we always say you're most closely associated here in Georgia with your longtime partnership with U.S. Senator Johnny Isaacson.
Bill, it's great to be here on election eve.
Yeah. We got a lot to talk about. And by the way, you can watch us on Facebook Live. Go to the GPB News page on Facebook, and we'll be there. And you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. We were sitting around before the show went on the air trying to get a handle on early voting in this election so far. It ended on Friday. And it, you know, it gives us some indication of what we might see. Todd, you were looking at those numbers. We had a total, I think, of 211,313 people cast early ballots in this runoff election.
And the most interesting thing from my perspective is that what we as political consultants often say, which is that local races and active races drive voter turnout, seems to be happening because you've got between three and four times as many Republicans voting early as Democrats, whereas in May it was much closer than usual. And especially if you look at Gwinnett County, you've got three Republican runoffs there for State House of Representatives. And in Gwinnett County, it went from being roughly 60-40 Democrats early voting in May to 60-40 Republicans, which is much closer to what we have always expected to be the norm in Gwinnett County.
Brenda, he's talking about your home territory.
That's right. And there are, besides the state house runoffs for Republicans, obviously the governor's runoff has, I think, skewed the numbers just across the board. Despite the fact that we do have a couple of, we have the 7th Congressional that incorporates some of Gwinnett County. But I do have to go back to the first point, which was during the regular primary, there was not just in Gwinnett County, Cobb County was one of the other counties that really shrunk the margins. That is not what we were traditionally used to.
Now, I think these are interesting numbers, right? You usually talk about runoffs having a dramatic drop-off in turnout, but I heard an estimate this morning you may have as many as 480,000, maybe 500,000 votes in a runoff in Georgia. Just a few years ago, that's how many votes you'd have in a primary.
And a July runoff.
And a July runoff. Jim. School starts next week. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not unprecedented. We've had runoffs that have been more attractive, and a lot of the times it has to do with simply winnowing the field. That, you know, the race has a lot more different dynamic when it's one on one than it's when it's a seven candidate field.
But Mary Margaret, should we be surprised that there are far more Republicans who voted so far than Democrats, given that Todd's right, there are some local races that Republicans are turning out for, but also at the highest levels on the ballot, you've got a gubernatorial runoff, whereas Democrats don't. You've got a lieutenant governor's runoff, whereas Democrats don't. I mean, that does drive voters, too.
Of course it does. And there is a real interest in this governor's race. I mean, the national press is on us. The president of the United States is on us. It's not at all surprising that this go-round we'd have a Republican interest.
Jim said there was a different dynamic, and part of the different dynamic is these horrible, horrible 9-week runoffs, whereas we're used to 3- and 4-week runoffs that have a much different feel than this. This is just a Bataan death march for everybody involved.
Really? And you, but that was required, I'm correct, right? This was the feds, Mary Margaret, you were in the legislature when you had to vote to change the runoff because of a federal requirement, right?
Federal requirement relating to military absentee ballots. What I've never figured out is why hasn't this affected the other states? I still see short runoffs.
You'll find some Republicans take issue with they think that Mr. Kemp caved on this one a little bit too early.
Mr. Kemp has many criticisms against him. This is one of the valid criticisms. When you see other southern states that are strong military states that don't have this enormously costly, problematical runoff schedule, I think they're right to blame Mr.
So
Kemp.
So wait a minute. Before we go further, let me make sure, because I want to correct an error I apparently made. This was not done by legislative action. Right. This was the Secretary of State overseeing the elections who responded to a federal request.
Federal mandate. Obviously, we moved the date legislatively, but we were following what we had to do under the court. So you were mostly right.
There are two things. One is that some of the other states have had, they do some sort of an online or an accelerated mail-in ballot for military personnel overseas, which is enough for the feds. The other thing, though, is that if I recall correctly, the federal mandate it is about federal elections and not necessarily state elections, so that if you have a general election runoff, there are different dates for the state runoff.
There can be the federal.
And here we have some federal runoffs in the 6th and the 7th district, as well as a state runoff. So it was the decision to keep them together on the same day.
And I think one of the interesting ironies of this election, right, is that what was perceived 6 weeks ago as a mistake by the Kemp administration in prolonging the runoff may have actually helped him, right, if we look back at the numbers, in an odd twist of political history.
All right, so let's talk about that. Let's get into the governor's race. It was an exhausting week of campaigning for the two candidates in that gubernatorial race. I saw one of the candidates here very early this morning, one of the two getting set to do something on Fox News Network. They rent space in our building. And I will say that he looked exhausted, bleary-eyed, getting set for a long day of fly-arounds across the state. So, yeah, this 9 weeks is having an effect on everybody. All right, let's talk about the big event of the weekend, the visit to Macon of the vice president. Let me turn to the Republicans on the panel first and get your feeling on how this thing worked out for Kemp.
Well, there's no two ways about it. When you look at the president's popularity with Republican primary voters across the state of Georgia, having the vice president of the United States in middle Georgia on the Saturday before an election was big for Brian Kemp. And there was a good-sized crowd there. It actually allows you to have – you struggle the last few days of a campaign statewide. What's new to talk about? Brian Kemp had it, and the vice president, who was also very popular and closely tied to some of our local Georgia folks that are operatives in Washington, D.C.
So, Todd, does that put the race – does that basically say this race is over?
I don't think it does. I think that if you were planning it and you were talking to the White House, you might have asked to have it maybe 2 weeks out, because – It's great to dominate the airwaves on the Saturday before the election, and that is going to be huge for Brian Kemp. But at this point, roughly, you know, between 30% and 40% of the electorate has already voted, and so they voted without the knowledge of the Trump endorsement. The other thing is that the Kemp campaign hasn't had the time to really hammer the electorate with that fact.
I do think it was significant on Saturday, just in recognition of the new dynamics of the race, that House Speaker David Ralston was on the tarmac to greet Vice President Pence. His people say that it wasn't an endorsement, but he was there.
Well, I think anytime the vice president comes to Georgia, David Ralston
I've seen governors run away from vice presidents before.
Yeah, but unpopular vice presidents, there's nothing that's for a Republican to want to duck in terms of this administration.
I remember very clearly sitting at this table maybe 8-9 weeks ago and us saying, Brian Kemp's not going to get any money. The momentum is clearly with Casey, not giving Kemp much. I'm pretty fascinated by this turnaround. I'm really trying to understand it in terms of the quote-unquote base that we all keep talking about.
Well, so, Brenda, let me start with you on this. I want to read a little bit of a statement that the Cagle people put out about an hour and a half ago now, and I think it's a really fascinating document. It's called This is Georgia's Moment by Casey Cagle. And here's what he says. There's nothing in a Republican primary runoff that's more crushing than having the president endorse your opponent less than a week before the election. It was a kick in the gut, and particularly so because during the 2016 election, I supported President Trump and my opponent did not. The fact is, the president doesn't know my opponent at all. He goes on in that vein, but then he personalizes it. He said, I've been kicked in the gut before. My dad left when I was a little boy, and by the time I was 10, I was helping my mom pay the bills by pushing a lawnmower around town. And then he goes on, all the while giving some props, being respectful to the president, and points out all the reasons that being, he says, beholden to the President Trump is not really in the service of the state of Georgia, citing as one example supporting any action the president might take on restricting foreign automobiles in the United States would be very harmful to the state of Georgia, given our Mercedes and Porsche interests here, as well as the Kia plant. I thought it was, given they're in a tough situation, and you may not have had a chance to read the whole, I thought it was a really kind of remarkable way to close the race.
Well, absolutely. I do have to agree that it would have far greater impact if it hadn't been this late in the runoff cycle. But what Cagle said is true in the aspect that, particularly speaking about Vice President being in Middle Georgia, a lot of the farmers, farm owners, and those that rely on the agriculture industry in rural Georgia, particularly. Had from going around throughout the state had a slant, I would say, towards Casey Cagle, and those decisions has already been made. So would a last minute tweet of an endorsement by the president that actually is doing not only issues as to the automobile industry, but you know the issues of tariff and tariff that's affecting very negative and will continue to affect negatively the agriculture industry, you know is that going to be counterbalanced, or is there enough time, going back to when the endorsement was done, is that going to be enough to counterbalance the support that Cagle already had?
Heath?
No, I think that the Casey Cagle campaign is doing the best they can, given the fact that it was a kick in the gut to have the president endorse, even as late as he did. It really is interesting, though. This is an appeal that Casey used to make all the time about his upbringing and the fact that he has kind of come from behind before. I think it was the most articulate way for them to deal with this. And I do think it's an interesting point to be making here. I was down in Albany over the weekend with a couple of great farmers and several other folks that are involved extensively in the agribusiness world of Southwest Georgia. And I really thought when I asked the question about what they were going to do that it was going to be an automatic for Kemp because of his commercials, because of Donald Trump. And I heard them say, we put President Trump in office. We're the farmers of America. We've been left behind. But his endorsement right now did not sway us. We're pretty upset with him right now because of the tariffs on pecans and soybeans and what they're looking at from their standpoint. So it's interesting. That's anecdotal. It probably doesn't apply to the whole state. But I was a little bit surprised that some of the folks that everybody presumes are going to be pro-Kemp and pro-Trump are backing off a little bit.
Business is the primary ethic of the politics of Georgia. And Casey Cagle has accommodated business every single day he's been there. Not consistently, we're saying this big industry, but that big industry.
I don't think Mary Margaret necessarily means that as a compliment, Galloway.
No, it's a little bit, you know, we don't have a zigzag zell term, but there are other terms that could be applied that the tape sort of demonstrated for us. So he has been loyal to business.
Jim, let me get you back in the mix on Sunday. Casey Cagle in Auburn amplified the theme that's in the letter. He said, I will be a bulldog for the people of Georgia and not a lapdog for Washington.
And you got, I saw that Twitter message and I said, he is taking a slap at Sonny Perdue. Because you've got Sonny Perdue out there day after day after day in farming communities in Georgia and across the nation saying, I will have your back when these tariffs really kick in, that we're going to find a way to make you whole. And to Heath's point, yeah, I think there are doubts being raised among some Trump loyalists in the agricultural community, but I don't think they've come home yet. And I think the Trump identity is still tied too closely to the Republican base.
Todd, the AJC's polling, most recent polling, showed that 21% of voters were going to make their decision about who in the Republican primary runoff they wanted based on whether they're the Trump person or not, who Donald Trump would be supporting, essentially.
And that goes back to what I said about the timing of the tweeted out endorsement. You can't simply say something one time to all of Georgia and have it remembered. My late wife always knew that she couldn't say something just one time to me and have it remembered by any means. You really have to have the time and the resources to hammer somebody and hammer somebody and hammer somebody. And, you know, the Trump phenomenon is bigger than anything we've ever seen in Georgia politics and national politics. But I always go back to the fundamentals, and I just wonder if it was not quite enough and not quite enough time to make Brian Kemp the clear Trump choice when Casey Cagle has been advertising himself as the Trumpiest candidate.
Jim, I want to put a bookmark in something. We're not going to get to talk about it in great detail today. We will have time in a later show, but it's worth mentioning just today briefly. The New York Times had a fascinating piece over the weekend in which they said that there are Republican governors around the country who were disturbed when they saw this Trump endorsement of Brian Kemp, which came out of nowhere, because it reminded them they're dealing with a wild card in the White House who could do anything if he wanted to play in their states.
Right. The New York Times story said they had somebody in the room when President Donald Trump promised not to get involved in state gubernatorial races, and here he was breaking that, and you do have people in the RGA who think that Kemp is not the strongest candidate to put forward in November.
All right, we're going to talk about that, as a matter of fact, in just a minute, but let me get a break out of the way early so we can continue the conversation. We'll do a little more with the governor's race, and then we'll look at some of the other races, the down-ballot races that people are going to be voting for tomorrow. This is Political Rewind.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
I'm gonna get in my car. Drive so far.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We got a full house. We need one. It's the day before the runoff election. Brenda Lopez is with us. So is Todd Rehm, Heath Garrett, Mary Margaret Oliver, and of course, my partner on Mondays and Fridays, Jim Galloway. I know a lot of you are watching right now on Facebook Live, and I wish for those of you who are not there yet, there's an awful lot of commenting going on that we can't get to on a show like this, but we'd love for you to go there and see what your fellow watchers, listeners are saying about the race. Brenda, let me, one last mention about the race. Tomorrow, Republicans will go to the polls to vote for a Republican candidate for governor. You would think that somewhere in the back of many voters' minds would be the notion that they want to elect somebody who they think will actually win in the fall. Now, Republican voters may feel there's no way they're going to lose. Democrats are going to retake the state. But Jim makes a point. There are people out there who think that Brian Kemp is not the better candidate to take on Stacey Abrams in the fall.
Well, that's definitely a consideration that is always discussed, right? Can the candidate win against the other candidate? And so on the Abrams side, I think that her strategy, as was shown during the primary, isn't going to change in terms of her outreach and that direct contact to voters. And so despite whom ends up being the Republican nominee, that won't change. Obviously, what changes is the messaging. And of course, I do think, and this is just a personal opinion, not related to the campaign on the Democratic side, that there is, to a certain extent, a lot more negative messaging that can be done of a lot of the different failures that Brian Kemp has had as Secretary of State. If you start from what we were discussing before about how long this runoff election is, whether you talk about the voter integrity issues that we're having with the Secretary of State under his authority, the fact that we have issues about whether we're going to have a paper verification for elections. So a lot of things that a lot of issues that he's had, even that Cagle has used regarding the fact that his through his company, they owe farmers money, that he has issues of related to taxes. So I do believe that Kemp does have a lot more negative messaging to be able to attribute towards his campaign. So to a certain extent, that is a consideration to take. But as we keep mentioning, right, where we are today in politics is that the disruptors of social media, the disruptors of what a Trump endorsement can mean long term towards a November election, and whether that will rile up enough Republican voter base to come out and vote that wouldn't necessarily have riled up if Casey Cagle wins. So I think that they're both there's plus and pros and cons to both sides.
Todd, you want to weigh in on that?
I would say that if you accept for the sake of argument the premise that Brian Kemp is the weaker of the two in November, I think that we can also say that we as Republicans kind of feel like Stacey Abrams is in some ways a better candidate to run against, because it seems to me like she's ceding the center of the political center to Republicans. Now, I will stay awake at night worried about her fundraising. But if Stacey Evans had been in there, I think it would have had a different quality to the November election. And Stacey Abrams, I think it's almost as though some of her positions are formed to split off a chunk of the left and to antagonize part of the center and all of the right.
All right. I'd like to reserve most of our conversation about what the runoff might look like for the show that we'll do after we have a candidate in the Republican contest. So if you don't mind, let's move on. Mary Margaret, I'm going to start with you on this. You've got David Schaefer, and I start with you because you have known him over the years. You were a member of the state Senate for a while before you went over to the House. And he's in what strikes me as a relatively surprising runoff with Jeff Duncan. I think many people expected Schaefer would win without a runoff. He came close, but it didn't happen. And this race has gotten really nasty.
Any time in the Senate, and I was part of it, where a third of the members of the Senate are running for something, it makes it a very unlikely place to have very strong friendships, or the friendships are much more narrow and much more seldomly lived out. Jeff Duncan, I really liked as a person in the House. I like the way he learned. I like the way he sought information. He's a super attractive guy, super attractive family, that Georgia Tech, that baseball kind of thing. David Schaefer is not personally well-liked and in my view, from the opposite side of the rotunda. David Schaefer's not been part of a consistent kind of leadership that people feel comfortable with. Jeff Duncan is a newbie on the largest, growing, fastest growing, wealthiest county in Georgia, with a really good resume. So it doesn't surprise me at all that they're really having a good fight about it.
Jim, set that, the terms of that race for us for just a moment. In other words, what are we really looking? Schaefer ought to pull this out tomorrow, shouldn't he?
Right. I mean, by every other measure, yes. But you do have a Senate candidate, and I'm talking about Schaefer here, who has been deeply involved in some very, very hard-fought arguments over, that really bring in the religious conservative movement, especially when it gets to RFRA. I mean, he has been part of that. You'll recall that during the whole he was a particularly nagging force to House members during the adoption ban. The adoption rewrite.
Yeah.
And did not earn any friends there.
And then took credit for the bill in his ad, which really pulled a little salt on the wounds.
Right. Now, and I think, Heath, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of Jeff Duncan's biggest financial supporters is also Rick Jackson, who is of a major healthcare industry here, who was big on that adoption bill.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is an interesting race to watch because by all political science former rules, if you got 49% of the vote, you should automatically win in the runoff. I've seen polling that shows that Jeff Duncan may actually be up in this race. David Schaefer was not able to raise as much money and outspend Duncan like he was in the first round. And then you do have a super PAC out there, independent expenditure, with a significant amount of money, doing some significant damage in that regard. And there's no question that there's several successful business leaders who are behind that.
So, Todd, go ahead.
I think that the dominant dynamic of the lieutenant governor's race is twofold. One is that David Schaefer does have within the Republican activist core a very broad and very deep reservoir of goodwill built over 20 years. But other than that, the dominant dynamic is $2.5 million of other people's money that is more intent on beating David Schaefer than on actually electing Jeff Duncan. And so I think the way some of that money has been spent was counterproductive to the extent that people are voting against Duncan because of advertising that was frankly out of his control.
You know, that's a really interesting comment. We've talked on this show before about ever since Trump's election, it's been a cycle of disruptors who are winning the day. Now, Duncan is hardly a disruptor himself, but on the other hand, as you point out, Todd, there are people out there who want to disrupt the much more conventional David Schaefer and his path through leadership is what you're suggesting, basically.
And some of them are the kind of folks who can give $1 million to an effort in the way that I might be able to give 50 or 100. And that has really changed this race, and I think that's going to be something to watch going forward.
Okay, well, we'll watch that closely. There's a Republican race for Secretary of State. I think one of the reasons we don't have to say a whole lot about it right now, the mayor of former mayor of Alpharetta, David Belle Isle, against State Representative Brad Raffensperger, who's put a lot of his own money into the race, right, Heath?
He's a big self-funder that kind of came out of nowhere and is now dominating a race.
And he'll take on the unimposed Democrat, John Barrow, former member of the U.S. Congress.
The winner will. The winner will.
That's what I mean. That's what I meant. I meant the winner, whoever the two of them. But, Brenda, one of the reasons it's always worthwhile with the Secretary of State's race is because they do oversee the elections. You talked about that a little earlier. And in this case, especially important because it's probably the new Secretary of State who is going to be looking at the new voting system in Georgia, which we assume is going to have a paper trail of some sort. Very important decisions to be made.
Absolutely, including vendors, including who you're going to contract out to. And so, you know, one of the key things with the Secretary of State that has been, regardless of what happens with the top ticket at the governor's side, that is one that could actually, you know, even if you say theoretically the Republican governor would win, it has the possibility of changing or not being in line down the ticket. Secretary of State's office is one of those that, with John Barrow being congressman of a district that had been changed and changed changed further and further towards the right, and having his base in southern Georgia, I think there's a good potential at regardless of what happens with our governor's election, that we could still win the secretary's office.
Yeah,
and very important.
Mary Margaret, there are people out there who think that if Democrats can win one constitutional
office, it's John Barrow
at Secretary of State.
John Barrow is a very, very strong candidate. The unhappiness on the election procedures on both sides is pretty intense right now. The efforts at voter suppression, all of the negative, painful issues all came through the Government Affairs Committee where I sat, where Representative Raffensperger sat. And he did not have a good, strong leadership record there. He was not really helping on some of these very complex issues, in my view. We all agree we need a new voting machine system. It's going to cost tens of millions of dollars. We all agree we need a paper trail. We all agree it needs to be audited. We all agree that we are facing very soon in the next 2019 General Assembly session a major budget appropriations for something. And the intensity around the views about what we don't agree with is how much is left for the computer to do, how much should be all handwritten. All of that is intensely felt. Raffensperger would not be a strong candidate on those issues, in my personal view.
All right. Galloway?
I would just say that there are a couple of reasons why John Barrow, the Secretary of State's race, is considered kind of by many Democrats to be the second most important race. And the voting machines are one, but also Secretary of State is the guy whose name appears on all these lawsuits when it comes to redistricting. So he'll have some influence over the redistricting that follows the census in 2020.
Gerrymandering, all that comes up as we move toward the census in 2020. Our colleague and friend Michael Owens, frequent panelist, Cobb County chair, of the Democratic Party, says, don't forget the Democratic runoff for state school superintendent. Yes, they're having one. Sid Chapman versus Ota Thornton. I don't know what more to say about that, Brenda.
Well, that is the problem with social media nowadays and just what grabs our attention, right? I mean, it's a very important school superintendent, but quite frankly, their race has been about talking about themselves and what they offer the position, and it hasn't been about throwing mud at each other. And so what that means is you don't get so much media attention, which is, again, it's great that they're actually running that type of campaign so that you're voting for what they offer, but it's not great because we don't have that statewide attention that we should have.
And it takes millions of dollars to even get name recognition. I've been involved in a few of these state school superintendent races where you have multiple candidates. The person at the top of the ballot gets the most votes, and the person at the very bottom of the ballot gets the second most votes. And that's the science behind it. Now we've got a runoff, so you're down to two folks. But there are some important offices that get absolutely no attention because the amount of money it takes in politics statewide. I think this is an open question, not for today's debate, Bill, but whether or not some of these offices ought to even be elected offices to begin with.
Voters have turned that down three times on the superintendent. I voted to make it not elected office every time the voter says I want it to be elected.
Sid Chapman is a former teacher and former president and president of the Georgia Association of Educators. Ota Thornton is a former president of the National PTA. So they both work to defeat Governor Deal's Opportunity School District back in 2016, and they both say that public schools need more money. They'll face the incumbent Republican Richard Woods in the fall.
I would say that sometimes the state school superintendent goes a little bit differently than that dynamic of the first on the ballot, because Richard Woods did after all win in a I think there were 7 or 8 or maybe 12 or 17 in his primary. And the only thing I thought about it long and hard after that race, and the only thing I could think of is that the two guys who made the runoff in the Republican primary that year were both in some way school system employees, longtime school system employees, and there must be some organization that was working to help those guys. And so in the Democratic race, since there's not a whole lot of money to be had, I think there's going to be a premium on organizational finesse. If you can tap into PTA networks, if you can tap into teacher networks, that's really the way to move the needle in a state school superintendent's race.
You want to take the last word in this segment?
Let me see. Get ready on Wednesday. Okay, we don't know who's gonna win. We won't know until late Tuesday, right?
Right.
Okay. On Wednesday, you can already say that the race for two PSC seats has begun, and it's very, very important because you've got two good candidates, good Democratic candidates there. You've got Tricia Pridemore, who's an incumbent, who's spared who has been spared a Vogel vote. You've got Chuck Eaton, who is the only exposed member of the PSC who had to cast a vote on Vogel.
All right, we have two important congressional runoffs to get to as well, both of them Democratic runoffs in districts that some believe could be crucial because there might be a possibility the Republican incumbents in those districts are vulnerable. We'll see. But let's take a break and come back and talk about congressional runoffs.
On the next Fresh Air, writer and critic Michael Arsenault talks with Terry about growing up in Houston, Black, Catholic, and gay, and learning not to suppress who he was.
Why would I do that? Like, what sense does that make to me?
His new memoir is I Can't Date Jesus, Love, Sex, Family, Race, and Other Reasons I've Put My Faith in Beyoncé. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Back on Political Rewind, day before the runoff, and I remind you one more time that you can listen to us tomorrow because this week we start the Tuesday edition of Political Rewind, which we're all really pleased we're allowed and able to do. Jim, 6th and 7th District Democratic Congressional runoffs tomorrow. They have gotten a lot of attention because there's a feeling that in the 6th, maybe Karen Handel, the incumbent, could be a little vulnerable. In the 7th, maybe the incumbent Republican Rob Woodall could be vulnerable. And certainly Democrats see it that way. So there's a lot of energy going into those two runoffs. Tell us, take your pick. You want to do 6th or 7th?
I'll do 6th.
Okay,
I'll
go ahead.
Okay, you've got Lucy McBath, anti-gun violence spokeswoman for a number of groups. You've got Kevin Abel, a very well plugged in businessman from Sandy Springs. You've got both of them are trying to unseat Karen Handel. And generally speaking, if you're in your first election after you've secured that office is the time when you are most vulnerable. You've got a hot topic in terms of imported car tariffs coming up, which could be damaging. And I would also argue that you've got a really interesting gender dynamic building. And that's one thing I'll be watching on Tuesday is just to see what the turnout is in the 6th there. Clearly, if you see a female wave in November, Karen Handel is going to be slightly protected because she is of that gender. You won't be able to just say vote for the woman. But I think it could get very tight. I think
the national trend we know since November 16th is a huge infusion of women participating in politics, from the 100,000 women who've come to the Capitol since November 16th to Carolyn Bordeaux and Ms. McGath on these two races. If you look at the national trend, both Carolyn Bordeaux and Ms. McGath, really have excellent chances tomorrow and moving forward.
Now, just to clarify, in terms of the women both running and being voted for, that's actually more true on the Democrat side. That hasn't necessarily panned out on the Republican side as giving, in this case, Karen Handel that extra boost.
But I do think in the general election, I think some of this about the 6th and the 7th district were overblown because of the Ossoff phenomenon. It was a special election. A lot of money flowed in. If the money's going to flow in November, it's going to be for Stacey Abrams. It's not going to be – there could be some incidental benefit there in those districts. But these two districts are going to revert back to norm. Donald Trump is a factor in it, but Karen Handel is the right type of nominee for that district. And obviously I worked it for a long time with Senator Isaacson when he represented it. And then Rob Woodall was also a great nominee for the 7th district, given the fact that you got to appeal to independent and suburban women.
The numbers that I was talking about earlier that reflect a significant dip in early voting among Democrats in Gwinnett County suggest that a lot of that early voting was not organic. It was prompted by voter contact from the campaigns. And with Stacey Abrams' campaign being both the strongest of the Democrats and probably the best campaign in terms of techniques for prompting early voting, You can see where some of the air comes out of some of these down ballot races when they don't have the top of the ticket out there. And so it's going to be an interesting question about whether the enthusiasm remains at the top of the ticket or whether they drop off as they go down the ballot. The other thing that I've been reading a lot about lately, and not just from newspaper reports, but I've been having readers of my email newsletter tell me that there are lots of what they presume to be Korean language interpreters showing up at the Gwinnett County polling places, largely an effort of the David Kim campaign, which is something I can't think of us having seen in the past.
All right, so right. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say in terms of the, about the sixth, I actually agree with you that the numbers are tough, but the seventh is a slightly different situation.
You're saying that to Heath.
Heath. Yes, I'm sorry. But the seventh is different because not only have the numbers actually shifted in terms of Republican Democrats, but also the enthusiasm and effort both from their top ticket, but also of the candidates that are running, particularly in the seventh. That's true. What we keep saying, right, until you contact and you touch a voter, they have less motivation to come out regardless of what happens politically, even at the national level. And so that's true. I went to vote Friday, my last day of voting and the last day of early voting. And there was several people that looked of Asian backgrounds. And I asked some of the polling workers there, and they said throughout early voting that had been a consistent. They've had a line of about a 10 to 15 minute wait outside the building consistently all through early voting. And so when you have when you're engaging voters that way, that can mark the difference in actually being able to flip that seat.
All right, so let's break it down again, if you don't mind. Separate the sixth and the seventh just for the sake of the next couple of minutes of conversation. Jim, I think and you may have a better handle on this than I, but it appears to me that both McBath and Abel in the sixth they've run pretty good campaigns, both of them.
Tough campaigns.
It's very tough.
McBath has had money, if not in her campaign, then speaking up for her. Kevin Abel has raised a good bit of money. To the seventh, Carolyn Bordeaux
and David Kim
are. I would take a little bit of. I disagree slightly with you, Brenda, simply because in the seventh, yes, there's Gwinnett, and that's been a remarkably changing community there. But a lot of that vote, somebody tell me how much, comes from Forsyth County.
That's right. Yeah. It's a large percentage and growing. And very motivated voters.
South Forsyth, I'm sorry to interrupt, but even South, because this really is South Forsyth, and even that included, if you're thinking south of Cumming, because that's the part that includes the seventh, it's true, it's still a very strong Republican area, but nonetheless, even the changes there and the population growth is people being pushed out of both Gwinnett County and North Fulton, that Sandy Springs kind of area. So even there, the numbers aren't as strong as they used to be in South Forsyth.
All right, so let me get to close out this part of the conversation, a take from the two people sitting side by side. First from you, Mary Margaret, and then you, Todd. Jim's already suggested Heath suggested that he thinks the question of the districts being vulnerable is overblown. It's the Cook Report that really started all that moving. The Cook Report kind of identified those two as possible flips. Are those districts going to be competitive in the fall? Are you excited about having your candidates up there, Mary Margaret?
What I'm very excited about is that the four Democrats running, two and six and two and seven, they're excellent candidates. They are really running good campaigns. They're well-funded. They're doing extremely well. They're quality candidates. I'm amused, as we seem to be down on education from our candidates right now, that Carolyn Bordeaux and Mr. Kim have degrees from Harvard and Yale. They're excellent candidates. We are in an unknowable ground swell of interest of politics in 2018. How it plays out, we have to admit, based on the things that have already happened that we did not anticipate, that 2018 is pretty much unknowable at this point. But when you have good candidates, well-funded, working like dogs every day, and you see movements, then you have to be hopeful.
Todd?
I think that the bigger threat from a Republican perspective is not that we're going to lose campaigns to Democrats in November. It's that the disruptors within the Republican primary have become so powerful and are able to do a lot more than even the campaigns themselves in a lot of cases. We know how to run a campaign against a Democratic nominee. We may win or we may lose, but we know how to do that. We're very good at that. We don't know how to run a campaign when the other guy gets endorsed by the president and the other guy didn't even know it. We don't know how to run against somebody with $2 million.
You could build Jim Galloway. He just gave you an entire column. That was a really, Keith, you'd agree with that.
That's absolutely the case.
And that's why you see a lot of the incumbent Republican governor members of the RGA freaked out about this.
By the way, we are told, I think I read it in your Political Insider, Jim Galloway, that speaking of the RGA, that on Wednesday, the Republican Governors Association, one day after the runoff election, is all set to start buying time on Atlanta Georgia TV stations.
They will dump a TV spot on somebody, I would presume, rather than it being on Kemp or Cagle, whoever is the victor. They will take the easy way out and go after Stacey Abrams.
I bet that commercial is already in the can and waiting to go. All right. We will be back here tomorrow. We got a few more minutes in this show, so don't go away. But I just wanted to close out our discussion about tomorrow's runoff election by reminding you we'll be here tomorrow to talk about how the day is unfolding. I hope we're going to get some voter sound bites for you, how people are making their decisions as they go to the polls. So let's now turn with the last few minutes, and I really didn't want to spend too much time on this, from the sublime to the ridiculous. Jason Spencer. Jim Galloway, Sacha Baron Cohen, has for a long time been an entertainer who's made a career out of playing bizarre characters and luring unsuspecting famous people into a trap of being ridiculous in front of them. Jason Spencer, Woodbine State Representative, may have reached a new low in Sacha Baron Cohen entertainment.
Yeah, this was he's done it before to Georgia politicians. Bob Barr was a victim several years ago, I think. I can't remember how many years ago, but it was all kind of in a desk on camera. This is a lot more. It's quite more graphic in terms of what Jason Spencer was persuaded to do.
It's really sad to me. It's very sad to me. Jason Spencer has lots of problems. He must resign, in my view. But I have to also say that he was the energy, the leader, and relentless on hidden predator bills. I was his number two signature for several years. I respect his energy, and I'm incredibly saddened.
So,
the Clay Tippins tape and the Sacha Cohen and who are these other people out there that are setting the ground up for people to make terribly mistakes,
right,
career-ending mistakes.
Real quick, Sacha Baron Cohen pretended he was an Israeli Mossad agent trying to help Jason Spencer understand how he could defend himself against terrorists. Spencer has said that he was really afraid of a terrorist attack because he had once introduced measure to which would disallow women from wearing burqas.
But he lives in Woodbine, Georgia.
But Cohen got him to do. I don't even want to describe in detail what he did. It was just horrible, Todd.
I do want to point out that we talk about being tricked or it's a choice to be on that show. It's a choice to behave in the way he behaves. So I don't think that there was any mistakes done
right
here.
But I do, to Jim's point about Jason Spencer being from Woodbine, I do want to mention that in his district is perhaps the most sensitive national security site in the United States, the Kings Bay Naval Base.
Okay.
And so that whole area is probably a little bit cranked up about terrorism.
All right. Well, we're not. By the way, this is a show that's on Showtime. It aired, the segment with Jason aired Saturday night, which is why there's all this attention right now. And I think, Keith, the reason we're talking about it is that we now have the governor, the Speaker of the House, and Greg Bluestein just tweeted about an hour or so ago, the Speaker, the two leaders, the minority leader, majority leader in the House, are calling on Spencer to be sanctioned, hit with an ethics violation, and the Speaker and the governor, like Mary Margaret Oliver, are calling for him to
resign. For his resignation, and he should right away. Look, as a Republican, there's no other choice here. Most Republicans identified once Jason made it to the House that he was a problem. He doesn't represent Republican values. He doesn't represent the party of Lincoln, and so much so that he was defeated in a primary already and was not going to be serving in January. He had already made outrageous and indefensible comments previously before, and I think lost because of those and other reasons. But this is an embarrassment, and it cannot be excused in any way, shape, or form. He had a choice. Some of this stuff was clearly too – he was just too willing to participate in it, and he needs to do the noble thing. The only thing he can do is resign and get on with his life. But I'm glad to see Republicans calling for him to get out of office.
I'm going to suggest to Jim as an editorial note that he include Borat and Clay Tippins in his disruptors column, because that is definitely also a new dynamic that we're seeing. I'm going to say that I think this puts a premium on good staff work in the press offices. Somebody who, you know, you can't just rely on somebody like me. You also have to have a millennial in there who can pick Borat out of a out of a lineup without his mankini on.
I'm not a millennial, but I know Borat well, Mr. Ream. I'm sorry. All right, look, we are. Enough of that conversation. Tom Faust and I talked before the show about whether we even wanted to pull an audio clip from that Showtime segment, and we've said why. It's pretty rough. It's pretty raw. He uses very derogatory language, and he actually exposes himself in a way that's just demeaning. So, sorry, Jason Spencer. All right, with the last couple of minutes we have here, Jim Galloway, tell us, because we're not going to see you until later in the week, where are we going to see you over the next day? Where are you going to be tomorrow? When will we finally get to see you writing about the election? I know you can't write about it for the Wednesday column.
Well, I'll be trying to write about it Wednesday morning. I mean, easily. Where will I be? I'm not sure yet. I know I will have a laptop in front of me.
Todd Ream, Heath Garrett, are you guys with Republicans tomorrow night, or are you home watching on TV?
I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina, watching the Pixies take the stage.
Oh my gosh, the Pixies! I love that's better.
That's a better option. I'll be at home watching and tweeting.
Brenda, do you have a candidate who you're going to show up to be with as the returns come in?
Well, I'm actually going to maybe do my rounds for both of the candidates for the 7th, and potentially a local race just from someone that I know. That's running down in Henry.
And Mary Margaret, you're always out there.
I'm going to be at Alan Abramowitz's house tomorrow night, who's a CNN political scientist constituent, and his wife, Ann Abramowitz, who's helpful on lots of campaigns, and I'm always interested in his views.
All right, Mary Margaret, I would like it known that we did not discuss this before the show went on the air. Alan Abramowitz, the political science professor from Emory University, has written a new book. Jim Galloway, he will be a guest on Political Rewind on Friday. You, Loretta Lepore, and I will get to talk to him about his new book, in which he talks about the realignment of this country, what it means, how it helped Trump get elected. I'm really looking forward to that conversation.
And what goes on in the next few years forward. It's look, we plan these things out. We're good at this.
That's right. So Friday, Alan Abramowitz again. We're back with you tomorrow at 2 for the first of the Tuesday Political Rewinds, then Wednesday at 2, and back with Alan Abramowitz on Friday. Thanks for being with us. I'm Bill Nigut. See you tomorrow.